Support for WPR comes from Lawrence University in Appleton, home to 1,500 undergraduate students from nearly every state and more than 50 countries. Dedicated to an engaging global education. Lawrence.edu.
Previously on Beta.
Did I just hear a peal of thunder?
You did, Tish, you did.
Oh, that's the most heavenly sound. It makes life worth living.
If she weighs the same as a duck, she's made of wood.
And therefore...
Away!
Lady, I'm afraid I'm going to have to ask you to leave the store.
Who the hell are you?
Name's Ash. Housewares.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to a spine-tingling episode of Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, writer Clark Collis joins us to talk about the making of the world's first rom-com, Shaun of the Dead.
They wanted to make a zombie film, but also I think they thought that it would be funny if they took the zombie aspect of it very seriously and clashed that with, you know, the romantic comedy genre.
Also, documentary filmmaker Kayla Janisse walks us through the woods of folk horror.
You realize that there is actually a lot of American folk horror, and it doesn't look anything like British folk horror necessarily. People didn't call these films folk horror, but when you think about it, Children of the Corn is absolutely a folk horror film. You know, there's no denying that.
But first, Cassandra Peterson, or as she's more famously known, Elvira, the Queen of Halloween, and the self-proclaimed horror hostess with the mostess. And who am I to argue? Cassandra has spent the last 40 years playing the charismatic character and has become a pop culture icon along the way. She hosted the popular syndicated TV series Movie Macabre. She also co-wrote and starred in two feature films, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark, and Elvira's Haunted Hills. But there's so much more to Cassandra's story than her alter ego. She's released a memoir called Yours Cruelly, Elvira, Memoirs of the Mistress of the Dark. It's a funny, touching, and ultimately revealing look at how a little girl from Manhattan, Kansas, became a horror icon. As she says, the drama began only a year and a half into her life.
My mother was dyeing Easter eggs, and she was outside, and we had a bunch of eggs boiling in a big cast iron kettle on the stove. And at the age of 18 months, I don't know, I was very smart, I guess. I pulled a chair over, climbed up to look in the whatever was bubbling around there on the stove, and must have lost my footing because I grabbed the pot and pulled it over on me.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. So it was a pretty bad burn. 35% of my body was covered in third-degree burns. Back in those days, 25% of your body burned third-degree was considered not survivable. So it really was kind of a miracle that I lived through that.
Yeah, lucky for you and lucky for us.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. You say that after the accident, you felt like a misfit with your burns and scars, but that led to your love of horror. How did that happen?
Well, kids made fun of me and teased me and bullied me about my scars. And I became very shy and withdrawn. At one point, sometime between second and third grade, my cousin Danny took me to see my first horror movie, House on Haunted Hill. And it just changed my life. I don't know. I somehow related to something in the movie. It struck me that way. I don't know. I've talked to other people, fans and everything, who have scars or disabilities and things. And I guess they kind of see a fellow creature in horror movies that they feel like it's them, you know, the person that everybody in the movie is running from and screaming, you know, about.
Yeah. You left home at 14, and within 3 years, you were performing at the Dunes Hotel in Las Vegas as the youngest showgirl in town. You met celebrities like Frank Sinatra, Sammy Davis Jr., and Tom Jones, but it was really your encounter with the king of rock and roll, Elvis Presley, that marked a turning point in your life. Can you tell us about this?
Elvis had a big, big impact on my life, I'll tell you. He came and saw my show in Las Vegas, which I could hardly believe that Elvis Presley was seeing me perform. And afterwards, we were lucky enough to be able to go to a party at his suite. And when I met him, we began talking, and we talked for the entire night. I mean, until the sun came up the next day. And later, he told me that he thought I should get the hell out of Vegas because I was too young to be there. And it was no place for a young girl. And it was kind of depressing because I thought I had finally achieved my dream of a lifetime. And that's where I would be until I became the oldest showgirl in Vegas, which would be now. And that would be really old. But he actually played the piano and we sang together. And he said, "You have a decent voice. Why don't you take singing lessons and maybe get in a band or learn to be a singer?" And him being Elvis Presley, I took his advice. And I went out the next day and got singing lessons. And before long, I was singing in my show and ended up leaving the show, going to Europe, getting in a band, where I toured for about a year and a half in Italy in a pop band. Definitely changed my life, changed the direction of my life, meeting Elvis.
Yeah. And while you were in Italy, you also appeared in a Fellini film. And eventually, though, you returned to Los Angeles. And that led to 4.5 years working with the legendary improvisational and sketch comedy troupe, The Groundlings. You worked with my fellow Canadian, the late, great Phil Hartman, and Paul Rubens, who's better known as Pee-wee Herman. What did you learn about improv and comedy acting from your time with The Groundlings?
Well, it was absolutely invaluable. I mean, I'd been toying around with comedy acting for several years before that, but hadn't really gotten an opportunity to study it and think about it and learn more about it. So The Groundlings was absolutely the best place I could have found myself. I am terrible at remembering lines. I was just absolutely awful at memorizing. So I thought, oh, this is fantastic. You just make it up as you go along. And people like Phil Hartman, who was one of my dear, dear, dearest friends, and Paul Rubens, and John Paragon, who was my writing partner, who is probably best known for playing Jambi the Genie on Pee-wee's Playhouse. Those three were the stars of The Groundlings. Everybody else was good, but they really stood out. And being able to see them and see how effortlessly they did comedy on stage and was really, really helpful to me. But I think the best thing about The Groundlings and about comedy improv in general is it is amazing confidence booster for anybody, even if you don't want to set out to be a comedian. I think it's fantastic if you're in any career, say you have to do public speaking or you have to be in front of an audience. There is nothing like learning how to do comedy improv to build your confidence and get you through those situations.
Excellent. Very good advice. In August of 1981, the local Los Angeles TV station KHJ asked Miley Nurmi to revive her Vampira horror hostess, Vampira. But she was in her 60s at that time and wasn't up to doing it. So you auditioned to play Vampira's daughter. How did the audition go?
Well, it was really bizarre through a weird bunch of circumstances. I was on my honeymoon when I heard about the interview and didn't get back for a week or two later. They were still looking for someone to replace Sinister Seymour, who had been the horror host in LA at this particular station for a few years. So I got called. I went in on the interview. And when I walked into the dressing room, the entire room was packed with women who were wearing black dresses, black leotards, black hair, fangs, you name it. And I was in my summery little turquoise dress and with my red hair. And it was like, yeah, somebody invited you to a costume party and, you know, didn't tell you you were supposed to wear a costume. So I think I was able to get the part because of my improv background, because the director really did want somebody. He wanted a woman who was sexy, but also funny. And that wasn't that in demand back in those days. So I think that the comedy improv, lessons paid off in a big way for that interview. And obviously I got it because here I am 40 years later still doing it.
You and your friend Robert Redding developed the look of the Elvira character. Can you tell us about that, about how you and Robert developed it?
Yeah, when I got the part, it was obvious I had to come up with a look that was spooky. And he and I threw around ideas about what I should look like because I had to be spooky. So our first choice was to go against the typical Morticia Adams kind of vibe and go with something that was more along the line of Sharon Tate in The Fearless Vampire Killers. Sort of a gauzy, diaphanous gown that was shredded and kind of long red hair, which I would be able to use my own hair, which was a great idea, I thought, at that time.
Yeah.
And then more pale makeup, pale lips with the more dead girl eyes, kind of, you know, dark eyes. And when we took the sketch into the management at the station, they were like, no, oh my God, no, you have to be all in black with black hair. So it was like back to the drawing board. So we took the basic black Vampirella, Morticia Adams look and tried to make it a little more 80s. We had a little leather and studs, and the hair Robert got from his very favorite singer of all time, Ronnie Spector from the Ronettes, who called her hairdo a knowledge bump. So we did that hairdo, and then Robert got the makeup from a book of kabuki makeup, and we put it all together, took in another sketch to them. They loved it. We were afraid of the cleavage, that it was going to be too low for them, but their only comment about that was, can you make the slit on the leg a little higher? So, you know,
interesting,
they were in
yeah.
for it for the ratings. Yeah,
yeah,
right? As
exactly.
long as it made money for the station, they were good.
Yeah. How did the character of Elvira evolve from TV to when you made your first feature film, Elvira, Mistress of the Dark?
It did evolve. I see old footage, I see my hairdo growing higher and higher. It started out kind of flat. And then every few months or every year, I see that my hair gets higher and higher. It got to a point once where I looked like a cone head or something. It was just like, this is insane. It got so high. And then we had to sort of bring it down a little bit. And then, we found a happy medium. But I was just trying out different character things, throwing whatever I could against the wall, seeing what would stick. I see old footage of the character now and just like cringe. Oh my God.
Hello, darling. Yes, sirree, it's little old me. That gal with a walk that makes the boys gawk. Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. And welcome back to Movie Mac, a Southland tradition here in the Southland. And this time around, we're serving up a classic tale of gothic horror. Classic, that's C-L-A-S-I-C-K. Of course, I'm talking about Frankenstein, Robert Foxworth.
So bad. But by the time I did the movie, I think the movie was a really, really good, besides just being a movie, it was an exercise in finding out who the character really was, because we had to write about her past. Where did she come from? Why does she look this way? Who is she? And I think all of those things really solidified the character for me.
Apparently Mrs. Talbot has a grandniece, Elvira, who was also one of the beneficiaries.
That's impossible. Who is this grandniece?
Hey guys, sorry I'm late, but then so's my aunt.
Hey, what'd she die of? Nothing serious, I hope. Say, nice jacket. Who shot the couch?
Hey, is there a bathroom around here? I'm telling you, that toilet over the cozy cot looks like somebody's science project.
Who is this woman?
This must be Mrs. Talbot's grandniece, Elvira.
Starting with Mistress of the Dark and going forward, it was a much more developed character, and I don't just mean the chest. I mean the actual character itself.
Yeah.
So it was very, very helpful in a lot of ways.
That's good to hear. You seem very proud of the fact that you became a pop culture icon later in life. You were 30, which you joke is over the hill for women in Hollywood. And since no one would rep you because of your age, you've always declined an agent. One could argue you've been subverting the patriarchy for your entire career. What does that mean to you?
Oh, yeah, that would be a nice way to look at it. I do feel like, although I have a wonderful team of people that help me, believe me, but yeah, I do feel like I kind of did it on my own in one way. I, was able to get around having an agent and just doing things more the way I wanted to do them, how I saw them. And I think it's, that part is very similar to the character of Elvira, because Elvira pretty much gets herself into messes all the time, but then she gets herself out. She doesn't need anybody's help, especially a man. Mm-hmm. She does it in a really stupid, ridiculous way, which is kind of how I do everything too. but she does it on her own, you know?
Yeah.
And if you do things on your own, then you get exactly what you want. You don't have anybody telling you, hey, change this, put this way, change your costume, change the way you talk. Yeah, you are totally in charge. And that's pretty much the way I've been. Ever since I started this character, kind of, it's me sort of calling the shots.
And look how far it's taken you and how long you've lasted and continue to last. So that's great. In your memoir, in your memoir, you reveal that you've been in a 19-year relationship with a woman named Teresa Weerson, or T. Why did you want to use this space to share your relationship with T?
Well, I wanted to talk about everything in my life. I really wanted to bring up things that I'd done in my past that I really hadn't told anyone. And I thought, if you're going to have a memoir, you know, spill the beans. That's what people want to hear. And, I just turned 70 years old, and it's like, okay, if I don't talk about this stuff now, when am I going to talk about it? But I've always kept my private life very private, because I feel I'm protecting a character. It's not me. If it was just me, the actress, going out and doing roles on TV or in films, I'd tell people what my background was. But Elvira is a very well-known straight horn dog, and I didn't want to inflict my personal life on her. When I was married, I kept that quiet, because I don't think people wanted to look at Elvira and think, oh, yeah, she's actually at home with her husband, you know, and changing diapers, you know, on her baby. I don't think people really wanted to know that. So the same thing with my relationship now. I just didn't want to have any reflection on the Elvira character.
That makes total sense. Were you surprised by all of the media coverage in response to the revelation?
I sort of was. I was like, wow, is it really that big a deal in this day and age? I don't get it. I mean, I guess when a celebrity comes out, people, it's interesting to people and they want to know. But me personally, I thought there were other things in the book that were more interesting. You know, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People glommed onto that. And then if that was the thing that got the book into the public eye, great. You know, T and I discussed it a lot first before I did that. I wouldn't have done it if she wouldn't have wanted me to. She's a very, very private person, and I don't want to suddenly bring all this, you know, attention to her, but she thought it was a good thing so that we can go around and be together and not have to worry about people wondering what the heck's going on.
Yeah, that makes total sense. Yeah. Cassandra Peterson, thank you very much for the great conversation. Congratulations on Yours Truly, Elvira. I'm looking forward to the sequel. Yours Truly, Cassandra.
Hey, that's a good idea. Thank you very much.
Cassandra Peterson is the author of Yours Cruelly, Elvira, Memoirs of the Mistress of the Dark. Find out more at WPR.org/beta.
You realize that there is actually a lot of American folk horror, and it doesn't look anything like British folk horror necessarily. People didn't call these films folk horror, but when you think about it, Children of the Corn is absolutely a folk horror film. You know, there's no denying that.
Coming up, Kayla Janisse joins us to talk about her bewitching documentary about the history of folk horror. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. What comes to your mind when you think of folk horror? Maybe that time Bob Dylan pulled out an electric guitar at the Newport Folk Festival in 1965? Well, that's not the kind of folk horror we'll be talking about here. We're talking about a subgenre of the horror film. Author and critic Kayla Janisse has made an expansive documentary called Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched. Kayla's doc explores the history of folk horror from the 1960s to the present day. It features more than 50 interviewees and touches on over 200 films. Kayla joined us from the festival circuit in Spain to talk about this growing subgenre and how to define it.
I think the sort of basic definition you could use would be to say something, you know, a horror film that takes place in a rural environment, almost always in a rural environment, that deals with some, to some degree, with folk customs, practices, or beliefs, and that often features small, isolated communities, and often there's a clash of belief systems that will happen between insiders and outsiders from those communities.
There are three films that are now known as the unholy trinity of folk horror. What are they, and what do they all have in common?
So the three films that are called the unholy trinity would be Blood on Satan's Claw, Witchfinder General, and The Wicker Man. Actually, Witchfinder General came first. So chronologically, Witchfinder General came out in 1968. And it is, you know, it's a witch hunting narrative, you know. So Vincent Price plays a witch hunter named Matthew Hopkins. He's going around the English countryside trying to, you know, basically making money, like collecting money from the villages to get rid of people accused of witchcraft.
You are all of you confessed idolaters. However, these proceedings shall be carried out through due process of law. What law demands, we shall satisfy. You will each be tied in a prescribed fashion and cast into the moat. Should you then sink, we will know that your confessions are false. If, on the other hand, you are seen to swim or float, then your confessions of witchcraft are proven beyond a doubt in the sight of God, and you will be withdrawn from the water and hanged by the neck until you are dead.
And of course, it's all a scheme, and he's very corrupt. And then Blood on Satan's Claw is about, like, a skull is unearthed in a field, and it ends up sort of having this demonic power over the younger generation in this village. So it's like all the kind of school children start to become affected, and that film is very much about kind of like the youth revolt, you know, like it's very focused on like the youth revolt and what happens when this, you know, community of kids stops following the rules.
Get away! I never want to see you in this school again.
Damn you, you old pig! Would you like to know what becomes of your precious pupils? One of them is dead already. Little Mark had the devil in him. So we cut it out.
And then the last one is The Wicker Man, and this is probably the most well-known of all the folk horror films. And this is about an isolated pagan community that lives on an island off the coast of Scotland, where a feudal sort of like a lord, you know, played by Christopher Lee, sort of oversees his constituents on this island who are all practicing the old ways as a means of sort of keeping up the harvest and keeping this sort of utopian lifestyle that they have.
I believe in the life eternal as promised to us by our Lord Jesus Christ.
That is good. For believing what you do, we confer upon you a rare gift these days. A martyr's death. You will not only have life eternal, but you will sit with the saints among the elect. Come. It is time to keep your appointment with the Wicker Man.
So they're all very different folk horror films, but it's kind of from those three films that people look at, you know, the tendrils of folk horror kind of stemming from those films in some way, you know. So there's many different types and sort of sub-genres of folk horror, but many of them will connect back, you know, to one of those films in terms of their type.
Mm-hmm. What is it that makes British folk horror different from the folk horror of other countries?
British folk horror it's very prolific. There's probably more British folk horror than folk horror from anywhere else. And part of that is because there is this really deliberate engagement with the old customs, the old practices, the history of the island. You know, like people are very nostalgic about the history of England. They're interested in the history of the different conquests, you know, and the different groups of people that sort of took over, and the way that certain religions went underground and then reemerged. They are very interested in their own history. And so folk horror was kind of like a natural type of film I think, for a lot of British writers and filmmakers to tap into, because not every country wants to embrace or delve into their folklore as much as the UK does. You know, if you think about Australia or America, for instance, our history is very upsetting, and it's dealing with, you know, genocide and slavery and things that are like living issues. These things are not old things. These things have not gone away. I feel as though all the things that British people kind of look back on with their own history, when we look back on it on, you know, with our own history, it's not with like this nostalgia, you know, it's something that's met with shame and guilt and a lot of negative feelings. And so I feel as though it just was kind of easier for a lot of British artists and writers and filmmakers and stuff to tap into that folklore and find real magic in it without it being coupled with the same sort of like guilt that we have when we start looking at our folklore.
How do paganism and witchcraft play out in folklore?
Well, I think like paganism and witchcraft are probably, and like the occult, like occult beliefs are probably one of the touchstones of folk horror. You know, it's one of the easiest ways to identify a folk horror film is if it has some element of witchcraft or occultism, especially if it is of like kind of a DIY variety. Anytime you have a film that has kind of like a local witch or a local shaman or somebody, you know, in the village that people go to for advice, like spiritual advice and stuff like that. If it's a horror film and it has a character like that, then usually you would call it a folk horror film. You know, and so much of folk horror is about beliefs that have been suppressed. You know, somebody is suppressing a belief system or attempting to suppress a belief system, but it is constantly threatening to reemerge. Sometimes those old beliefs are the scary thing in the movie. They are the thing that are villainized, that have to be stamped out, that are providing the horror or the threat in the film. But other times, those are the things that save everybody. You know, like it's revealed that those folk practices and beliefs are actually things that are necessary to the well-being of the community.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a bit about American folk horror. What is unique about it?
Well, I think one of the things that makes American folk horror unique is that America is so big, you know. So as people moved around the country and created like all these settlements, you just end up with kind of regional types of folk horror that look different from each other. When I was first considering it, it still felt very tied to British folk horror. And then as you start looking at the way that people moved to like Appalachia, you know, and moved out west and moved to the prairies and all these kind of things, like you realize that there is actually a lot of American folk horror and it doesn't look anything like British folk horror necessarily. People didn't call these films folk horror, but when you think about it, Children of the Corn is absolutely a folk horror film. You know, there's no denying that.
Mm-hmm. One of the talking heads in the American folk horror section is Jesse Wente, executive director of Canada's Indigenous Screen Office, and he has some very strong opinions about the trope of Indian burial grounds that is used in many American horror films. Can you share a few of Jesse's thoughts with us?
Yeah, I mean, Jesse was great, and he, like, I specifically approached him because I wanted him to talk about the Indian burial ground, because I knew he was, you know, he's an Indigenous activist, but he's also a horror fan, you know, like, I've known him as being a horror fan for a long time, and so that was really important to, you know, because I knew that he would have seen a lot of these movies that came out in the 70s that coincided with the kind of Red Power, you know, with this really strong wave of the Red Power movement, and it was during that time, the 70s, when it was such a visible moment for Indigenous activism, that you started to really see this trope of the Indian burial ground come up in movies a lot. And one of the things that Jesse points out is that it's a piece of fiction that's been created by white settlers. So many of the horror films that deal with the Indian burial ground are about people building their houses on an Indian burial ground. What Jesse talks about is this idea that the threat of thinking about the Indigenous people that have been displaced by colonization, the threat of that for the settlers is that they have to face the fact that they have displaced people and that that can happen to them as well. You know, this, so this is like a fear that colonizers have, is that someone is going to take their home or their land away from them, you know, and that this is why it's so common for their homes to be built on an Indian burial ground in these movies. He sort of points out a lot of the problems with the Indian burial ground and how it's just a ridiculous idea. And there's so many sort of indigenous nations that have different burial practices and everything else that it's just the way that it's used in fiction is just so inaccurate.
I'll tell you one other thing about the Indian burial ground, though, that I sort of like it. Because if non-indigenous people are going to be afraid of the Indian burial ground, then I got some news for you. It's all an Indian burial ground.
I mean, it was chilling when he said it when I first heard it, but it was even more chilling when the film premiered at the Fantasia Festival in like July. Right around the time the film started playing around was when they discovered all these bodies at the former sites of residential schools all across Canada. Bodies of like kids that were forcibly taken from their communities and put into residential schools with the aim of assimilating them into white culture by like punishing them if they used their own language, you know, like not allowing them regular communication with their families and their communities. And so many communities were just like broken up and displaced and disconnected from each other. People have often talked about it as that just creating that disconnection was an act of genocide in its own. It's something that definitely creates the kind of anxiety that's going to show up in horror films like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's definitely one of the most powerful parts of the film. There's been a revival of folk horror over the last 10 years. Most people are probably aware of Robert Eggers' film The Witch and Ari Aster's Midsommar. How do these modern takes on folk horror stack up to traditional folk horror?
The folk horror films that have been coming out in the last decade, one of the things that marks them as distinct from the earlier wave of folk horror films is that they are deliberately folk horror.
What went we out into this wilderness to find? Leaving our country, kindred, our fathers' houses. For what? For the kingdom of God. Let us pray.
You know, like a lot of the older folk horror films, the writers and directors would not have necessarily considered them folk horror films. That term was not widely used. But before then, you know, a lot of these films would have been looked at as being in different brackets, different genres. You know, they wouldn't have been discussed together in the same conversation. So there is a little bit of resistance sometimes from the older filmmakers to this kind of terminology or this kind of categorization because they're like, well, I don't really see how my film fits in the same category with that other film. But, you know, starting in the last decade or so, filmmakers and writers want to make folk horror films. They set out to make these films. You know, they're like, I want to write a folk horror film. I want to make a film that is set in a rural paranoid community or something. You know, so the films are more deliberately checking the boxes of everything that all the folk horror studies that have been happening in academia over the last decade, you know, they've identified certain things, as the movie does, that are, you know, certain things that are kind of hallmarks of folk horror or motifs that are common in folk horror. And so the newer folk horror films tend to actually try to get those things in their film.
Kayla Janisse, thank you very much for joining us and congratulations on your documentary, Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched, A History of Folk Horror. It is awesome. Kayla Janisse is the director of the documentary Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched, A History of Folk Horror, and it is now available on video on demand. Find out more about folk horror at wpr.org/beta.
Essentially, the experience of living in a modern city is very similar to the experience of what it would be like in a zombie apocalypse anyway.
Coming up, Clark Collis has the inside story on the making of one of the finest and funniest horror comedies ever, Shaun of the Dead. That's after the break. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I think you should do it.
I think we should all do it.
Who can five people operate one gun?
None of us have any real experience, okay? Now, we've only got
29
bullets.
Call them shells.
We've only got 29 shells. We really need to work together on this. I need someone to help me reload, everyone else to look out. I will fire. As Bertrand Russell once said, the only thing that will redeem mankind is cooperation. I think we can all appreciate the relevance of that now.
What's that on the back of a beer mat?
Yeah, it was Guinness Extra Cold.
I won't say anything.
Thanks.
That's a clip from Shaun of the Dead, the very first rom-zom-com. That's short for romantic zombie comedy. The film starred Simon Pegg and was directed by Edgar Wright. Simon and Edgar co-wrote the hilarious and at times horrific screenplay. I think it's safe to say that Shaun of the Dead is the greatest horror comedy since Mel Brooks' Young Frankenstein. You may disagree, in which case we'll settle this outside after the show. I am not joking. Clark Collis is a senior writer at Entertainment Weekly magazine. He's also the author of You've Got Red on You, How Shaun of the Dead Was Brought to Life. Clark tells us how Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright joined forces to create the film.
They sort of knew each other a little bit in London and then worked together on this TV show called Asylum, which is a very, very, very low budget sitcom, essentially. And so Edgar directed the show and Simon was the star. And in the course of making the show, they started talking about the things that interested them. And they realized they were both fascinated with George Romero's zombie movies. And then later on, Edgar directed this show called Spaced, which is a sitcom, essentially, I guess you would say, about slackers sharing an apartment in London. And Simon Pegg was the star of that. And one of the episodes featured that he stayed up all night playing a zombie video game and then began hallucinating that his apartment was filled with zombies and started shooting them.
You want a piece of me? Come get some.
Oh, hiya.
Don't sneak up on me like that.
Want a cup of tea?
Yes.
And they both enjoyed shooting this scene very much. And then in the taxi ride away from the studio, Edgar said, you know, we should make a zombie movie. Mm. So they made a zombie movie, although it did take them a long time to get that off the ground.
Yeah. Even though Shaun of the Dead was going to be a horror comedy, Edgar Wright thought that it should have a far more realistic tone. Why?
It's interesting because people, I think, and this aggrieves Simon and Edgar. Simon and Edgar wrote the script together. People refer to Shaun of the Dead as a spoof of zombie films, and they're very adamant that it's not a spoof of zombie films. What it's a spoof of is the kind of Richard Curtis-written London-set romantic comedies like Four Weddings and a Funeral and Notting Hill. It's a spoof of those films. What they did was not spoof the zombie genre, but they made a zombie film. And then the comedy in the film comes from, obviously, the clash of this sort of serious horror aspect with it taking place amongst slackers in London, really. But they took the zombie element of it very, very seriously. When they were huge zombie fans, the production spent a lot of time and money getting the effects right. I think there are moments in that film that is truly awful and terrifying. And then, you know, people get disemboweled and shot and all sorts. They wanted to make a zombie film, but also I think they thought that it would be funny if they took the zombie aspect of it very seriously and clashed that with the romantic comedy genre.
Yeah, hence the description of Shaun of the Dead as a romantic zombie comedy or a rom-zom-com.
Yeah, they pitched it. I mean, it did take them a long time to get the money for the film. They pitched it in numerous ways, one of which was Richard Curtis shot in the head.
One of the most surprising things I learned from reading your book was that Edgar and Simon shot the movie as if it were taking place inside George Romero's zombie universe. And could you kind of flesh that out, pun pretty much unavoidable for us?
Yeah, for those who aren't so knowledgeable about the zombie genre, director George Romero and his collaborators in Pittsburgh essentially invented the entire genre in the late 60s with their film Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, this room looks pretty secure. If we have to, we can run in here and board up the doors. Won't be long before those things be back pounding their way in here. They're afraid now. They're afraid of fire. I found that out.
And George Romero also established over time a set of rules to do with zombies. You know, if you get bitten by a zombie, you become a zombie, and so on and so forth. And so what's interesting is in a sense, you've got a strict framework, a strict set of rules, but the nature of the franchise also you know, allows other people to kind of play in that area because there's no particular sense of time or place to it, really. And so, yeah, they decided to, they would essentially make a George Romero movie, albeit of a, you know, of a more comedic fashion than Romero, although Romero's got quite a thick sense of humor as well.
Mm-hmm. What did Romero think of the film?
I mean, I interviewed George Romero a few times before his passing, and he was a famously lovely man, and that was certainly my experience. And he loved Shaun of the Dead. And then, amazingly, George Romero made a fourth zombie movie, Land of the Dead. I mean, it's not amazing that he made it, but he called up Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright and said, do you want to make cameos as zombies in the film? And so Edgar and Simon flew to Canada to appear as zombies and then were sort of heavily featured on the posters that came out. And I'm not sure Universal, the film company that produced Land of the Dead, even realized that they had, like, you know, the director and star of Shaun of the Dead on their posters because they were, I mean, heavily in makeup apart from anything else. That was a lovely coda for Edgar and Simon.
Romero was famous for including sociopolitical satire in his film. And Edgar and Simon came up with this genius bit of sociopolitical satire a la Romero for the premise of their film. What can you talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. So the idea that I mean, there are lots of ideas in Shaun of the Dead. It's a fascinating film. But the idea is that if you live in a modern city, that essentially the experience of living in a modern city is very similar to the experience of what it would be like in a zombie apocalypse anyway, that people just sort of shuffle around, don't pay much attention to each other. It can be quite isolating. Everyone's sort of doing the same thing. Shaun of the Dead opens with scenes of, you know, cashiers working at a supermarket and sort of teenagers shuffling down the street, and everybody's kind of doing the same thing. And, you know, you could half think there were zombies. And then in you know, the two of the most famous scenes in Shaun of the Dead are this pair of long shots. And in the first one, it's before the zombie apocalypse properly happens, and Simon Pegg's character walks down to his local shop, like his deli, I guess, in North London, and walks back. And then later in the film, there is a second shot, which is almost identical. I mean, what Simon does is almost identical. But this time around, it is obvious to the audience that there are zombies everywhere. But it is not obvious to Simon Pegg's quite hungover character, Sean. Which is just, you know, I mean, it's absolutely hilarious. And then this time around, you know, it is clear that something awful has happened. And there's, I mean, in the shop, there's this bloody handprint on one of the refrigerators. And Simon Pegg slips on something. You can't see what it is. It means off screen, but you're clearly supposed to think it's blood. And, you know, and then he comes back to his house. And then eventually he and his flatmate, his roommate, played by Nick Frost, realize that something is awry when one of the cashiers from the start of the film sort of turns up in their back garden. And eventually they realize she's a zombie.
Oh, my God. She's so drunk.
How much have you had, love?
Oh, thinks she likes you.
Shut up. Thinks she wants a cuddle.
Listen, I'm serious. I've just come out of a relationship.
Do something!
Wait there.
Ed!
2 seconds.
Jeez, look, I'm really flat and everything, really, but I just...
And hold it there.
Ed, just get her off me! Jeez! Whoa, what's up with her eye? What's up with her eye?
Now, seriously, Mary, I'm warning you, okay? I'm going to have to get physical. I mean it. This is it. I'm going to...
Edgar Wright is very innovative in the way that he uses in-camera transitions to really amp up the visual storytelling. And Simon Pegg has said that Wright uses a magical realism style. What part did Edgar's unique style play in the success of Shaun of the Dead?
There are so many elements to this film that I think attributed to the success of it. And whenever people sort of ask me why I think it's successful, I always think it's an answer that, you know, I could give one or two or three sort of answers and that'll be it. But then I'm still talking 3 hours later and I'm on sort of like reason number 127.
Yeah,
the transitions are fantastic. And again, as something that and the visual style is amazing and it's something that obviously he would refine, I guess, and demonstrate again and again through his filmography. I guess it is a transition, but there is a sequence in the film called The Plan. And it is this moment when Sean and Ed, Nick Frost's character, finally realize that the zombie apocalypse is happening. And they're talking about what to do.
So, what's the plan?
Right. We take Pete's car, we drive over to Mum's, we go in, we take care of Philip.
I'm so sorry, Philip.
Then we grab Mum, we go over to Liz's place, pole up, have a cup of tea, and wait for all this to blow over.
Why have we got to go to Liz's?
Because we do.
She dumped you.
I have to know if she's all right.
Why?
Because I love her.
And it's always accompanied visually by footage of them actually doing this. It's something of a magical realist sequence. Things like that are absolutely crucial to the visual look of the film and the style of the film and the comedy of the film. And yes, I'm sure is a big part why the film was a success. You know, even more so why, you know, why it continues to be beloved over the years. But just as a footnote to this, that sequence, The Plan, has become, I guess, probably the most memeable part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And the things that they wanted to cut, that financiers wanted to cut, have become... You can't imagine Shaun of the Dead without it now.
No, exactly. Why do you think Shaun of the Dead has become such a beloved film?
Well, as I said, there is like a seven-hour answer to that, which I think ultimately involves me getting out a whiteboard and starting to write on it.
Shades of the Plan.
No, very much so. I mean, look, there are so many things. But one of the answers is its rewatchability. Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
It is packed with so many things. And obviously, I mean, it has a lot of references to horror. I mean, no one's called like Inspector Cronenberg or anything, but there are references to horror movies. But it's just more the jokes that are in the film that sort of come back over and over again. And I mean, I remember enjoying Shaun of the Dead a lot when I first saw it, but it's certainly a film that I enjoyed more and more and more over time and continue to love, just because you could watch it and be like, I've seen this film 117 times and I did not notice that little joke. Or maybe that there are so many jokes that I, you know, did notice it on the seventh time of viewing and then, you know, had forgotten it in the ensuing years. I think it's aged well. I think there are, you know, a lot of comedies from that period that have not aged well, and I actually think this gets more and more impressive with each passing year.
Mm-hmm. Over the years, Edgar Wright and Simon Pegg have talked about making a sequel to Shaun of the Dead. Do you ever think they will?
Well, that's not entirely true. They talked a lot about it immediately before the film came out, and then immediately after the film came out.
Okay.
It's. I mean, certainly over the years, people have wanted them to do it, and still continue to want them to do it. They had a few ideas, but one of which I would have loved to have seen, would have been to start the film in an identical fashion, essentially, with, you know, as if the previous film had not existed. So you've got Simon and Nick's characters living together. But this time it wouldn't be zombies, it would be something else. Possibly, I think vampires were thought of for a second. And then Edgar came up with the idea of possibly body snatchers, you know, a la Invasion of the Body Snatchers. That would be the sort of the monster they'd have to deal with this time around. Also, I mentioned that Edgar and Simon did cameos on George Romero's Land of the Dead. And Edgar talks about... George Romero spent almost his entire career making zombie movies, making horror movies, rather. And then towards the end of his career, was really only making zombie movies because those were the only films for which he could get finance. And George asked Edgar and Simon what they were going to do next. And they said they had this idea for a cop comedy, which became Hot Fuzz. And George Romero said, oh, so you're escaping. Meaning, you know, you're escaping the horror genre, you know, which is something that, I mean, I know George Romero wished he could have done more. And I think this reconfirmed with Edgar and Simon that they were making the right move to move on from horror. And in fact, I mean, it's now, 17 years since the release of Shaun of the Dead. And it's only now, interestingly, that Edgar Wright is coming back with another horror movie, Last Night in Soho, which I haven't had the pleasure of seeing yet, but I understand is a horror movie of a very different stripe from Shaun of the Dead.
Clark Collis, thank you very much for the great conversation. It was a slice of fried gold.
Thank you so much for having me.
Clark Collis is the author of You've Got Red on You, How Shaun of the Dead Was Brought to Life. Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Cassandra Peterson, also known as Elvira, Kayla Janice, and Clark Collis. If you're not too scared to listen to it again, feel free to do so whenever you'd like to. We pride ourselves on our re-listenability. Beta is available to follow on Spotify or wherever you catch your favorite pods. Just search for WPR and Beta. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
All right. I admit, he can be pretty funny on occasion.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Somebody has to take control of the situation.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Look at the face. It's vacant with a hint of sadness.